Good afternoon. You're listening to Classical Music here on West Virginia Public Broadcasting. I'm your host for this hour, Matt Jackfort. Here with me are two special guests, and we have Maestro Grant Cooper of the West Virginia Symphony Orchestra and Luo Sha Fong, a violinist who's going to be performing with the West Virginia Symphony Orchestra this Saturday for their All Sibelius concert. She'll be playing the Sibelius Violin Concerto. Luo Sha, so you came to the United States from China in 2005.
Mm-hmm.
Where in China are you from exactly?
I was born and raised in Shanghai, China.
Okay. Mm-hmm. And so how do you pronounce your name exactly? I know you have sort of tones you have to say with it for the Chinese.
Right. So in general Chinese, we start with last name instead of first name.
Mm-hmm.
So if you know you're in China, you would probably call me Fang Luo Sha instead
right.
of Luo Sha Fang. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. So and this is sort of what were the origins of your name? You said it was not necessarily Chinese exactly.
Yeah. It's very interesting because on my father's side, everybody's musicians. Starting from my grandpa. So I have a lot of cousins and relatives who were raised and brought up in the West. For Chinese tradition, you have to pick capital as like the family name. So it starts with L. So my cousins, their name are Lucy and Louis. When it comes to me, my parents, they figure, you know, maybe Luo Sha sounded nice. It sounds a little bit like East European Russian. And actually, it is a Russian name, except it's a boy's name.
Oh, really? That's really funny.
So that's not actually a Chinese name at all?
No, no.
We're going to talk quite a lot about this tomorrow at noon. Is that on the stage?
Yes.
Yeah, on the stage of the Clay Center. If you come in through the Walker Theater doors at the back, that's by the hospital. And be there ready to go at noon. Luo Sha and I will chat a lot about her ethnic heritage, actually, and how it's impacted on her being in America today and what it means to be an international musician living in the United States. Some of you will recognize immediately that our orchestra has got a slightly different look for this concert compared with the last one because two very dear colleagues of ours from Bulgaria were forced, due to immigration law, to return to Bulgaria rather unexpectedly. Smiljan and Julian, and
yeah.
So we miss them greatly. But
really
I'm going to take this as an opportunity to talk a little bit about what it means to be an international musician and here living here in the United States and how that's changed actually from the time when I came here 40 years ago and certainly in the post 9/11 era, how things have really, really altered. But really, the big discussion this weekend is going to be about Sibelius because we have one of those rare programs. There aren't that many composers, actually, that you want to do all that composer. You can imagine all Beethoven for sure. You can imagine all Brahms for sure.
All Cooper?
I can't imagine that at all. You can imagine all Jackfort, I'm sure.
Maybe.
Yeah.
Not yet.
But Tchaikovsky might be another one where you can imagine all Tchaikovsky. But even if you start to get all Prokofiev, now that doesn't seem to work quite so well, even though he's a fantastic composer. And so here, all Sibelius is interesting because we get a real opportunity to understand the basic musical imprint, I would say, that a given composer makes and makes what sort of statement they make when they write music. And Matt, you as a composer too are probably not consciously trying to write yourself into your pieces. They just are yourself.
You can't even help it.
You can't help it, right. And you have certain images, I think, certain ideas of the way sound is produced. In the case of Sibelius, for example, it's impossible to imagine his musical ideas, especially the big ones that we know and love so much today, as being for anything but orchestra. It seems like he conceives this music for orchestra, and his violin music, he was a violinist himself,
mm-hmm.
of course, is conceived for the violin. And so maybe that's where we could start, Luo Sha, just talk a little bit about how this particular concerto, as opposed to, say, the Tchaikovsky, which was written by a pianist,
mm-hmm.
or Brahms, that
mm-hmm.
was written by a pianist, how the Sibelius concerto or written by a violinist maybe feels differently under the hand, or how do you think?
Yeah, as you mentioned, Sibelius was trained to be a violinist. I believe he had this really big desire and passion he wanted to be a concert violinist. Unfortunately, it didn't really work out.
I think it was undone by his stage fright, is what I understand.
Like everybody else.
Like everyone else.
So you can definitely, and this is his only violin concerto ever written.
His only concerto, in fact.
Yeah, violin, wrote, yeah.
Yeah, he didn't write for any other instrument.
Yeah, right. And you can see a lot of virtuosic writing for sure. And I wouldn't say it's definitely, I don't think it's really, really comfortable to play. Actually, he already changed a lot of things because originally he wrote a longer version, mm-hmm. which was actually much, much more virtuosic and much more technically challenging. But I think this this particular concerto, it sounds extremely virtuosic and has lots of depth emotionally. But I don't think it's really, really 100% comfortable to play. Yeah.
Is it really difficult? Some of the leaps and or some of the passages?
More about the rhythm.
Okay.
That's the big part, I think, because you talk about the difference between his music and versus, you know, Brahms or Beethoven. You can tell he the general form is still based on this German tradition. It's very clear the form is like that. But he definitely put a lot of his own national identity into this particular music. You can hear, it definitely doesn't sound like, some typical piece in early 20th century.
Yeah.
And especially in cadenza, he had a lot of very, very interesting rhythm, and that type of rhythm, I believe it's really largely influenced by his own culture. And
the fact that not everything lands on the beat, for example, mm-hmm. and gives us a sense of uncertainty, like mm-hmm. he's not sure at the beginning, he's not making a statement, he's more asking a question. I wonder if you'd go over to the other microphone and maybe play the very opening of the concerto for our listeners, because it gives you a sense, the two things that I would say, adjectives I would apply to this music is, number one would be searching. Number one would be searching for something solid to stand on. And the other one would be loneliness, I think. There's a sense of loneliness to it. And even the orchestra's doing almost nothing during the course of this opening. And yet over this, the violin wins this incredible melody, which is looking for something, right? But sounds so incredibly lonely. Losha, would you mind playing it from the beginning? So even though it's lonely and it's just a single voice speaking, there's nothing at all reticent about the music, is there? It's a very strong, very powerful personality that's mm-hmm. being represented, I think.
Mm-hmm.
And yet there's very much a sense, I think, of the orchestra and the soloist kind of getting to know each other almost, finding ways to engage.
Yeah, and I have to say this is I think it requires a lot of, great musicianship from the orchestra. It's not a typical solo violin concerto because it's not just the violin solo part versus accompanying part. It's like the orchestra has a lot of
they have their own difficult parts.
A lot of interaction. It's more or less like a chamber music work.
Well, and it comes back to this idea I mentioned before too, that the music the orchestra plays can only be played by an orchestra. that this is almost too direct if you listen to a piano version, and I'm sure you've played it with piano in recitals and for practicing and so forth, but it doesn't have the mystery, it doesn't have the ambiance that we need to get across in the mood of the music. The mood is very, very strikingly portrayed, I think.
Do you find the sort of exposed beginning to be difficult, and you know, as in maybe you have to have more control because the orchestra is playing so soft and you have this very lonely violin solo?
I wouldn't say it's because of the technical part. I think it's like, for me, it's like trying to be a good actor. You have to immediately get into your character, which is, you know, as you mentioned, it's very lonely, longing, and sad feeling. It's a little bit with distance, but you still have to have really true emotion and depth.
Right.
So it's hard to capture it right away.
Yeah.
But I wouldn't say it's because it's like it's not because I feel it's being exposed.
Okay.
Now, your question, Matt, though, might have applied more to the very first violinist who played this piece. Would not have expected this kind of what we would call support from the orchestra. That's not support. It's just staying that sense of distance, you know. And oh gosh, I've got to tell this story. Esa-Pekka Salonen has a wonderful joke that he tells about how do you tell an extroverted Finn from an introverted Finn.
Huh.
And he says, in an introverted Finn in the elevator, introverted Finn looks down at his own shoes the whole ride. Whereas an extroverted Finn looks down at your shoes.
It's a great joke.
Oh,
it's
wow.
a very good joke. And I think there's a lot of truth, as there often is in these quips, to that idea behind the joke. And yet a first performer who didn't know what this was about, who was discovering for the very first time, no records, you know, no MP3 files or digital files that could mark it up, just standing there in front of the orchestra, what's going on? I don't feel any support. When, in which case, Matt, your question would probably be, absolutely, that person would have felt very strange and naked and so on. But because we know the drama, because we have read the play in advance, we know the score and we know where we're going with this, in fact, it's hard to imagine that it could begin any other way, right? I mean, this is just so fabulous, right?
Right.
Now, I think the second movement, you mentioned the Germanic organization of the work, is important because of its key structure. It has to have a certain relationship to the D minor of the overall movement, right? So it goes to key of B flat, which is a relative, closely related key.
Yeah.
So maybe you could play a little bit of the music that you play to begin the second movement. And Lois is going between microphone setups here. I'm just covering for her as she goes underneath the recording microphone with the ambient concert hall behind it. Right.
Thank you.
Beautiful. The second movement of Sibelius' Violin Concerto. And we're talking about the integration of the musical ideas with the orchestra itself. And the important thing about the orchestration, and it's very skillfully orchestrated, this piece, I think, is that Sibelius uses dark colors, predominantly the clarinets and the bassoons in the woodwinds, and the violas a lot in the strings,
yeah.
Leaves the violins out completely, because there would be this sense of competition. And one thing he was obviously keenly aware of as a performing violinist himself is the issues of balancing a violin concerto. And there are other concertos written around this era. I'm thinking of Dvorak, for example, which are big challenges, mm-hmm. in terms of their orchestration and mm-hmm. the ability of the soloist to be heard.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm really always really taken every time I do this piece by how skillfully Sibelius has used his orchestration ideas in order to enhance the collaborative,
yes.
aspect of the music making. Mm. Right, it starts out with very lonely clarinets,
yeah.
for example, and so on, and then this beautiful melody full of potential and full of other meanings. I think,
yeah.
It's really really something.
It's torment.
And torment, yeah.
Yeah.
So let's talk about this. You use the idea of torment when you're actually playing this music. Do you try to enter into some sort of emotional state that you can describe, apart from just simply happy and sad, but
mm-hmm.
a tormented soul, a hopeful soul in torment, you know, it's
I would, because I think this particular violin concerto has very complex sort of a characteristic. I wouldn't say it's, because it's passionate, also you know, being almost a cold at the same time,
mm-hmm.
Extreme melancholic, but with hope. I would say for me, I have to constantly picture that I'm not just being in one person's kind of a character, which is, you know, of course, this has a really, really beautiful human voice, and it's really passionate. But I have to constantly remind myself sometimes it's like a big picture outside of this view, because Sibelius was really influenced by landscape and nature. So there's a huge part of that, how to depict like a swing and nature. At the same time, you have to capture human voice and human character, which is, I think you have to, for me, I just have to try to be different kind of people at the same time. I don't know. Yeah.
When we talk about the symphony in a few minutes, I'd like to come back to that idea, I think, because there's some really characteristic moments in the symphony that demonstrates exactly what you're talking about. And if I may make a few comparisons to the landscape of New Zealand compared with Finland as well.
Oh, I love New Zealand.
I'm glad to hear that. And we'll talk about that in just a moment, but the thing about the orchestration that we started talking about here is really brought out clearly to me in the third movement,
mm-hmm.
because, again, the violas are often the top string sound there. He's not letting the violins
mm-hmm.
get in your way. And when the violins do play, he only wants two or maybe three of them to play at a
mm-hmm.
time, which is extraordinary. You've got 14 first violins there, and he says, no, only two players here. So he's keenly
mm-hmm.
aware of making sure he doesn't get in your way.
Mm-hmm.
And yet there's a... Also, the other thing that I think is fascinating about this last movement is that it's important that we get the right tempo for you, because you
yeah.
have all of the notes
to play.
You know,
everybody has different opinions about it.
Uh-huh.
It's very interesting, because I realized that the tempo marking is different on the score versus on the violin part.
Is that right?
Yeah. And the one on violin part is slower than the one on score. Yeah, so it's a... Yeah, it really
that's really
well. It's interesting because it's a very easy tempo to get going too fast in the orchestra, because there's this jump, da-ga-dum, da-ga-dum, da-ga-dum. The ricochet idea of the bow tends to give its own impetus
mm-hmm.
and own speed that it wants to.
Yeah.
But you, on the other hand, if you wouldn't mind demonstrating how this begins for you in just a moment, you have to play something with a completely different character,
yeah.
And with that da-da-da-da-da-da, that internal rhythm, which is so. So energized
mm-hmm.
within this dum da da dum da da dum. If it rolls too fast in the orchestra, I can imagine why the violin part would be marked a little slower, actually, than the
mm-hmm.
than the orchestra, because you've got to be careful not to
maybe.
Let it get away. So
maybe that's why. Uh-huh.
Yeah. So maybe here's a little bit about what the violin starts out by doing in the last movement.
Thank you.
explain?
No, no, that's good. That's good. Okay. So what I'm imagining as I'm listening to the Osho play here is that the orchestra is playing don, dot, dot, don, dot, dot, don, dot, dot, don, dot, dot, don, underneath this, and the timpani the other way around, dot, dot, don, dot, dot, don, dot, dot, don. So you have pop, 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 but that dum, dot, dot, dum, dot, dot, dum already as I sing it wants to go faster.
Yeah.
Shun, dot, dot, don, dot, dot, don, dot, dot, don, because it just bounces along at that speed. But then dum, ba, da, ba, da, ba, da, ba, da, it would have a completely different character.
Yeah, I think I imagine this. This is a very. I was curious because I wonder when I was learning this piece. I was thinking, is it a typical dance that's originated in Finland, which is similar to this type of a dancing style? Because it's extremely wild. In a very rhythmic way. I don't know. I was just trying to picture if there's like a certain dance. It's exactly like that.
And what did you find? Did you find that it had any sort of relation
no,
to folk music? Or?
No. But as Sheila, because Sheila, she wrote an article talking about this violin concerto, and she found that was it Sibelius who quoted, who had a quote talking about this? Dance of...
Dance macabre, yeah, like kind of a macabre dance. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's so I think it's Sheila very... Shafi from the West Virginia Symphony Orchestra, by the way.
So I imagine probably that's a very sort of a close picture I have for this movement.
Yeah. Hey, maybe what we'll do is come back to talk in the last part of the program with Losha about the concerto and about her violin playing and everything.
Okay.
But do you have something set up on the stereo that you could play a little bit of the second symphony for us?
Of the second symphony?
Yeah, symphony number two. That's the one we're playing.
Okay.
I hope.
Yes. Just one moment. I do have that.
How long is that second movement? Does it say there on the case?
14 minutes.
Well, 14 minutes, that'll be good. That'll take us to 42, 43.
Okay.
Yeah, well, let's lay that second movement down. And as you're keying it up, I'm going to ask the listeners to be really aware of the fact that individual sparse-sounding voices are playing here at the beginning. The pizzicato, there's a timpani roll that just starts it all alone. Then the basses play this pizzicato, trades to the cellos, back to the basses. And then this lugubrious melody that's played by the bassoons comes into our consciousness, and we're constantly being introduced to individual characters like they emerge from the mist or the darkness. And if you can imagine the climate and the winters of the northern European countries, it's dark a lot of the time. It's a black and white kind of landscape, a gray landscape, and this is where Sibelius, I think, really can't help himself but to capture this kind of life experience. So can we do a little bit of the second movement?
All right, 14 and a half minutes strong of the second movement of Sibelius Symphony Number 2, and this is the Boston Symphony Orchestra, Vladimir Ashkenazy conducting.
So that's the second movement, or most of the second movement of Sibelius' Second Symphony. And I think as you listen to that, you can hear this idea that we've been talking about earlier of loneliness and of contrast of various orchestral planes of sound, these incredible sheets of sound from the brass and from the woodwinds and the strings. They're in opposition to each other, and they're independent of each other. It's not a full orchestra sound like you get from, say, Tchaikovsky or from Beethoven. It's these ideas of like a glacier carving itself into the ocean, and suddenly it's gone, and you're just left with this sheer face of rock in front of you, and you stare it down, and then the next one happens and it comes at you from a different angle, and then the weather comes across and it whips through your parka and chills you to the bone. You know, I mean, this is it's visceral music, I think, if you can really get into the contrast. And this is not a New Zealand piece. It's not an American piece. It's not an Australian piece. Or this is definitely a Finnish piece of music. And this is one reason why Sibelius to this day is revered in Finland as kind of the national beacon of what really music means for Finland. And which brings us to the first piece we're going to play on the program, Finlandia, perhaps its most famous piece, and certainly around the world that is true, but it's come to represent Finland for all of us. And it's a piece that's often played by younger orchestras. It's probably the first introduction they have to Sibelius' music.
Yeah, actually, I first played it with the West Virginia Youth Symphony with Bob Triziani leading the charge there. And I played tuba on it. And it has a nice tuba part. Boom, yeah. Boom, 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 boom. That part.
That's right. Yep. A little five-beat rhythm, right? Uh-huh. It's great. So we're going to do a side-by-side experience at this concert. The audience will hear the West Virginia Youth Symphony and the WVSO side-by-side play Finlandia. I had a wonderful rehearsal with the young students on Monday evening at their regular time, and they'll come in and rehearse with us over the next few days. And in the performance on Saturday evening, I think, should be a real celebration of our community spirit and our involvement in our West Virginia musical community, music of Sibelius, but with the West Virginia Youth Symphony sitting side by side with our WVSO. So what else? Let's talk to Losha one more time about, just generally, about what else is on her calendar this year. What other sort of repertoire are you playing? You're playing chamber music as well as orchestral music?
Yeah, I play a lot of chamber music. I have a coming up chamber music concerts. That's in May. We have some Bach, some Schumann piano quintet. Then afterwards, I have like a appearance in Washington, D.C. I'll play some contemporary music because I'm a really big advocate for modern contemporary music.
Yeah, as you should
and,
be.
And I have some good composer friends, so I'm doing their piece, and then I'm going to Marlborough, where you only play chamber music for two weeks, and then in September I have to do this Bach's Goldberg Variations, the string trio version of it. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I'm playing viola. As a matter of fact, I'm going to Spain right after this to play for Nobuko Imai. I'm just trying to explore as much as possible on different repertoire. So, yeah.
Is there anything you might want to play as before we leave? Is there anything else you would like to play of any of that repertoire? Anything short, maybe?
Sure. I mean, I can play a little Bach.
You're thinking of a modern piece or some.
I mean, whatever. It's up to Losha, I would say. But either one, as long as there's something maybe short, brief.
Oh, short and brief.
4 or 5 minutes.
Okay, 4 or 5 minutes.
You're on the spot.
Yeah, okay. I know. Yeah,
so
yeah.
We'll keep talking, and if something comes
can
up.
Can I quickly look at my music?
Yeah, absolutely.
One thing I noticed when Loisha was unpacking her instrument to play during this hour was that she actually has two instruments in her case.
Yeah,
I only saw the scroll of one of them, but it turns out it's a viola, not a violin. So I'm assuming from that she's equally comfortable playing the viola as the violin. And as our listeners may know, there's actually a different clef in the front of most viola music, and alto clef, as opposed to the treble clef of the violin.
Right.
So it's not just a question of it's just a slightly bigger cousin of the violin. It really takes a whole new...
The strings are... it has a C string, too, as well.
It's tuned an octave above the cello,
uh-huh.
The viola is,
yep.
As opposed to an octave below the violin, perhaps, which is... not quite as much as you'd expect. So the viola is a very interesting instrument because for its range and register, it needs to actually be a bit larger than it currently is. But if it were larger, you wouldn't be able to fit it under your chin.
Right.
I didn't bring the contemporary music, but I can play some Bach.
Yeah, that's great. No, okay. Let's do that. Okay, let's hear a little.
Which Bach are you thinking of, or should we guess?
Bach
Chacon. Chacon. Oh, do we have time for that?
Oh,
you cut it. Okay. So here's the Reader's Digest version of the Chacon.
Okay, all right. Here we go. Lo Sha Fong playing live at West Virginia Public Broadcasting.
Thank you.
Beautiful music of Johann Sebastian Bach.
And yeah.
Bach was known in his own day as mainly as a keyboard player, as an organist, but he was also a very accomplished string player. So I'm going to go back to the first question we asked you about Sibelius Concerto, his being a violinist. Is there aspects of Bach's writing for the violin that suggest that he indeed was a string player to you? Or is he, 'cause I know it's incredibly challenging music to play, isn't it?
Yeah, I think you can tell from a lot of arpeggio and the octaves and, you know, staccato. That type of writing is very typical for virtuosic violin writing. But it's still, I don't think it's very, very, very comfortable to play. Yeah.
What about someone like Paganini? Would you find that any more comfortable? That doesn't sound like a yes.
Is there any music that's comfortable to play? Let's put it that way.
I think it really depends. For me personally, I always find it very, very comfortable to play contemporary music, not because they are less accomplished or for that type, but maybe because I'm from this era. I am present, and these composers are present. In a way, I feel that we sort of speak the same language, so that helps me when I play music, because it frees my mind. I don't have to try to imagine what it was like 200 years ago, or what it was like, you know, in Finland or Germany
20 years ago, right?
Yeah. Or Bach was, you know, how was it like to be a man who had to work for church, you know, every single day. It takes imagination. But so when you ask me what's more comfortable, at least for me, it's contemporary music.
Yeah. That's a good advocation for contemporary music, you know, right? We need to have music written in the language of our time. Of course, so that's...
And it describes our time, too, just like the music of earlier times described their time.
And Sibelius did with his symphonies back in the 1800s and 1900s.
Yeah, but same idea, I think, going back. For me as a musician, I would try as much as I can do, try to bring music from, you know, earlier years to our present time. Because I do believe that it doesn't matter what year the music was written. If it's great music, it speaks to any of us in our time. It doesn't mean they were, you know, very... they were from tradition. They were from, old school of thinking. But the message behind is always the same. It's human. Humanity and heart and soul, and that's always the same. Yeah.
Well, just to touch on what we'll talk about tomorrow at noon at the Clay Center in our Humanities Council lecture, let me ask you this. Do you have any particular affinity for Chinese composers, for example, or does it not make any difference to you?
You are talking about Chinese folk music, like Erhu or...
No, I'm talking about contemporary...
Contemporary.
Chinese composers.
Yeah. I do have a friend who we happened to be a schoolmate when I was at college. He's Chinese. He actually wrote a concerto for me. So I premiered it here with an American orchestra, interesting enough. And the title was Mulan. As you know, people made a film about this Chinese heroine. Unfortunately, because I don't live in China now, so I don't have a lot of connections there. But obviously, if I do have friends reaching out to me wanting me to help playing their music, I'm always.
Are they mostly Chinese people of Chinese heritage who live in the United States then that you would intersect with?
Or? Actually, one of my best friends now, he. So the composer I mentioned, the Chinese composer, he wrote a concerto for me that was six years ago. But I do have a lot of other composer friends because now I'm based in Philly. One of my closest friend, his name is Michael Jepstrom, and he actually teaches at Curtis as one of the professors. we worked a lot together. I played a lot of his chamber music. He's 100% American. Last year when I had a debut recital in Philadelphia, he wrote a very, very intriguing. Unfortunately, I didn't bring the music. I wish I could. He knew that I really loved folk music from like Romania, and because we both really adore Enescu as a composer, so he wrote this solo violin piece dedicated to me because it's folk music based and it's extremely virtuosic, but the tune is like from Romanian folk song. Yeah, so I do have a lot of and also I just played a piece by this composer called Jeffrey Mumford. Have you heard about
him? I'm sorry, I have not. No.
Yeah. So he was a student of Elia Carter. I play a lot of Elia Carter's piece as well. Mm. I also played. So in general, speaking, I think I'm really open-minded, Chinese. A European or American,
old or
folk
new.
Or Korean or Indian, whatever. If it's great music, I think there's always a
whether it's contemporary or older or anything. Yeah, that's great. Well, that's good to be open-minded and be able to have a lot of big, diverse repertoire that you play.
Yeah.
Are you sure? Any last words?
Yeah, I think we're just talking about the international nature of musical language and the fact that once we begin to speak that international language, we find that. Especially in today's age, I think where musical cultures are shared so readily and quickly and immediately, that an idea that may originate in Turkey is is in Australia already, 24 hours later maximum, and then people are copying that and integrating that into their own musical language and structure, just as they take on certain idioms, and American idioms, for example. Flood our language, don't they? And American iconic things like Levi Jeans and Hollywood and Disneyland and all the rest of it, and American movies generally, have become so dominant in world culture that there's a sense of directors, say a film director from Italy, is trying to take on some of the characteristics that they adore about American film direction, and in so doing, create then a new challenge for American film directors as well. Mm-hmm. So it's a really an amazing time to be alive, I think, and so different from the time of Bach when musical culture was shared so slowly and so painstakingly. It took so much effort to get a piece of music from Leipzig to Bonn and have it played there. Someone had to carry the piece of music with them. Just extraordinarily different from today's
stuff. Even going to concerts, they have to.
They have to go to a concert to hear music. That's right. You can't just turn it on your radio.
Well, now here it is, the 21st century. We have a American orchestra led by a New Zealand conductor with a Chinese violinist.
I wonder where you're going with this.
Premiering a Finland composer's music. That's coming up this Saturday at 8 p.m. at the Clay Center in Charleston. Join us for a 21st century experience that you can only get here with the West Virginia Symphony Orchestra. Well, thanks for coming on, Lo Sha. Thanks for coming on, Maestro
My
Grant
pleasure.
Cooper. Join them tomorrow night at 8.